Our next case this morning is in the matter of Kmart Corporation. Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you. Good morning. As the court knows, I'm Rick Godfrey. I represent Handelman Company. I'm one of three appellants arguing this morning. We've agreed to divide our argument pursuant to Rule 34C. I'm going to take approximately 5 minutes or less to address a threshold issue of who can be bound by the appeal. Mr. Brunstad is going to follow me with approximately 9 minutes to discuss the statutory authorization for the critical vendor's order. Mr. Frank's going to follow with 9 minutes to address the now nameless doctrine, equity, and the prudential finality, if you will, and then jointly we reserve 7 minutes for reply, which I'll take approximately five, and Mr. Brunstad too. At least that's the plan, and we'll see how it works. There's a threshold issue here that applies to my client, Handelman, and to Mr. Brunstad's client, Irving Paper, and to many others, which is this. Are Handelman and Irving Paper and others bound by Judge Grady's judgment? Parties to a judgment are bound by it. Non-parties are not bound by it. My client, Mr. Brunstad's client, many others, never received notice, never had an opportunity to be heard, never knew about it, and found out after the fact. And promptly after Judge Grady issued his opinion on April the 8th, Capital Factors went running into court and told Judge Sonderby, you've got no choice. There's got to be a turnover order in effect. You've got to recover the money. And since that time, Kmart has sued my client in an adversary proceeding, which Judge Sonderby stayed in deference to this court, because she believes this court has jurisdiction. But the question is, are we parties who can be bound or not?
What difference does it make?
Well, it makes a big difference, because if the judgment does not apply to my client, then...
What difference does it make? Your client will be entitled to litigate this in the adversary action that's been brought, but it doesn't make any difference whether it's technically bound, because this court's opinion will have a precedential effect, which will be conclusive on the bankruptcy court, whether you were a party or not.
I agree with the latter.
What difference does it make?
It makes a difference because only parties are bound by judgments.
It's the difference between the precedential and the preclusive effect of a judgment.
Yes, but when...
So far as the bankruptcy court is concerned, operating in the same circuit, that's a distinction without a difference. So who cares?
Well, it matters in this sense. If we are not a party who is bound by the judgment, when they go after critical vendors who receive the payments...
You can make the defense, and you will lose on the basis of precedent unless we reverse this decision on the merits. If we affirm it on the merits, right, what difference does it make to your clients whether you lose on the basis of precedent or you lose on the basis of preclusion?
It makes a big difference in terms of whether we are bound as a party or not a party. Generally speaking, in this country, and we gave the court different types of examples. If you, and the Supreme Court's decision in the Bank of New York case is a very good one. If you're not a party to a judgment, you're not bound by it. It's like the person who says, I'm going to appeal it to full
counsel. We're not communicating. Somebody who is adversely affected by the precedential force of an order is not bound by it, but is going to lose anyway. What is your client's interest in having the bankruptcy judge say your client loses by reason of precedent rather than your client loses by reason of preclusion?
In this case, it's not, I don't think, the hypothetical that the court is talking about in terms of a decision coming down saying here's the law for the circuit, you happen to be in this circuit, the law applies to you. We are the person with the $49 million in our pocket, and according to Capital Factors, this judgment means we've got to give it back. No defenses. Judge Grady says...
You're not addressing my question.
I'm trying to address your question, obviously unsuccessfully at this point. Parties who have no opportunity to be heard, but who could have made their arguments before Judge Grady, cannot be, they're not parties, they should not be bound by the judgment. You would say,
look, the question I'm asking you is, suppose we agree 100% with your argument, and we put in our opinion 2 pages saying everything you say is absolutely right. Will it do your client any good? So far as I can see, it won't. So why should we care? Why does your client care?
Okay. 2 reasons. Number one, when it comes to what Judge Grady decided, which is that you cannot unscramble the egg, my client's one of the eggs that never had the opportunity to explain to Judge Grady why did you can't unscramble it, and
you
they will
explain
argue.
Explain that to us. That will influence what we do on the merits. But if we decide on the merits that the first day critical vendor's order was not a sound order, what difference does it make to your client whether you lose by virtue of preclusion or whether you lose by virtue of precedent?
It will make no difference if the court's holding means that someone is bound in effect even though they are not a party and that they had no opportunity to be heard. I think that's a novel concept.
That's the consequence of precedent. After the Supreme Court decides Brown against the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the Board of Education of Wichita can't remake the claim, even though Wichita was not a party to that case. It loses by virtue of precedent.
That's obviously correct. We happen to disagree with the application here because we were subject to the court's order, and as someone subject to the court's order, we think the precedents say we should have had the opportunity to be heard on that. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time. I think the light has come on. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. Mr. Brunstad.
Thank you. Eric Brunstad on behalf of Irving Paper. 3 points, I think, that I'd like to make this morning. The first is that the Bankruptcy Code authorized the Bankruptcy Court to enter the critical vendor orders. The second point is that the Bankruptcy Court applied the correct standard in entering the orders. And the third point is that even if the Bankruptcy Court applied the wrong standard, the critical vendors relied on the orders, gave up rights, extended credit, and are entitled to the full benefit of the order.
You know, Kmart identified which vendors should be considered critical. What in the record would assure us that that determination was made at arm's length?
Your Honor, I think that if you look at the record and review it carefully, you'll see that Kmart applied essentially 8 different considerations to try to winnow the list of trade creditors down to those who are most critical. It considered, for example, expressly, was the vendor a sole source vendor? Secondly, did the vendor provide critical infrastructure, as in the case of Handelman and Fleming? Third, price. Fourth, terms, whether they were favorable to Kmart. Fifth, quality. Could it secure the same quality from another source? Sixth, the effect of termination, whether it would be incredibly disruptive. And lastly, whether or not they wanted to avoid litigation. All of these sort of subsumed within the business judgment.
None of them, of course, goes to the question whether this vendor would actually stop selling if not paid accumulated sums due.
Well, we know, for example, Your Honor, that Fleming
could any reason in the record to believe that these vendors would have stopped selling?
We know, for example, that Fleming said expressly that they would have stopped. We don't know for sure, because the record doesn't expressly say whether other vendors would absolutely have stopped, but that's the question of...
If we uphold, you know, this type of payment, wouldn't that encourage all major vendors to threaten to discontinue supplying the debtor in hopes of obtaining full payment?
But we've had this regime, Your Honor, for over 100 years, and it's worked very well, where debtors such as Kmart have been able to resist those who are not truly critical, and has been able to say, look, in this case there was that pressure, and yet Kmart limited the list very narrowly to 4 critical categories. And what Judge Sonderby considered was she considered properly so a motion and a proposed order was, and she looked for things such as bankruptcy court.
Let me ask the question in a different way. why would it have been in Fleming's interest to stop selling?
Because, Your Honor, as
if you have sales that are profitable on a going forward basis, why would you shoot yourself in the foot by not making them?
Because, Your Honor, as of the petition date, Fleming was owed $76 million. And
yeah.
Kmart
and
wished
so
to
what?
Kmart wished to increase that exposure to $176 million.
Yes.
Which, of course, would raise huge alarm bells for Fleming.
And
why would we give that?
We all know that sales after the filing of the bankruptcy are administrative priority.
Correct,
and they will
Your
be
Honor.
Paid with certainty.
No, Your Honor, that's not
question,
true.
The question I am asking is, why would Fleming commit the sunk cost fallacy?
Because, Your Honor, Fleming at that point, if it was not reasonably assured of payment, would be behind, for example,
okay, look,
the diplomat.
A bankruptcy court can enter an order assuring Fleming of payment for future sales.
No, Your
that,
Honor.
Yes, counsel. Don't quarrel. Yes, it can be done.
Your Honor is correct.
Given that that can be done, why would Fleming commit the sunk cost fallacy?
Because, Your Honor, if that were to be done, it would have to be done under Section 364D to give Fleming super priority ahead of the other secured creditors, the DIF lender,
well,
and the private property claimant.
Address my question.
I am, Your
why
Honor.
Why would Fleming commit the sunk cost fallacy?
Because, Your Honor, of risk. It needed compensation for the risk. The risk it was taking is that this case would end up like Caldor, which was administratively insolvent, in which case all of the administrative claimants were not paid in
full.
Well,
does the record contain any affidavits or testimony from the critical vendors establishing that the failure to pay these pre-petition obligations would result in the termination of goods or services?
What the record, no, Your Honor, what the record does contain is that Kmart was not willing to play chicken with these particular vendors to say, we're willing to take on the potential disruption and the potential damage to our business in these four critical core categories. Take, for example, the egg and
dairy. Well, why in the world wouldn't there be testimony or affidavits in a case? The biggest what? The biggest bankruptcy in the history of the United States?
Well, Your Honor, what Kmart had to do is it had to set up a situation immediately to continue the business relationship it had
with
its
vendor
partners.
How long does it take to prepare an affidavit? I really have a problem with that.
Well, Your Honor, I will concede that in this particular case, the luxury of time is perhaps one you often want to afford in this kind of context. And in some bankruptcy cases, we do have more time. We have 15 days or more to prepare these kinds of cases. In this situation, Kmart's bankruptcy was somewhat of a crash landing. It was denied what it thought was going to be its restructuring financing and found itself having to file bankruptcy very quickly. It was in a position where it was going to be very seriously in an out-of-stock position. Fleming had said, we are not going to continue shipping. Other vendors and other that Kmart identified as core and critical, were, if they were to go away, if they were to walk away, would have been hugely disruptive. But even if the bankruptcy court should have required more evidence in this case, we still have a situation in which the bankruptcy court did the best job that she could. She allowed the extensions of credit.
I'm puzzled by the best job that she could. Are there any findings of fact to the effect either that these firms would have stopped selling, that such things as super priority would not have induced them to sell, or that this order worked to the benefit of the other unsecured creditors?
Yes, Your Honor.
I couldn't find any such findings.
On the first page of Judge Sonderby's order, there is an express finding that it's in the best interest of the estate.
No.
We'll talk about a generic statement.
You really have to listen to my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a finding that this order is in the best interest of the other unsecured creditors?
The best interest finding says the relief requested in the motion is in the best interest of the debtors, their estates, and their creditors. If not, it is, Your Honor may characterize
it. The answer is no, there is no such finding.
Other than this, there is not. That is the only one.
How do you respond to the argument that the threat posed by the critical vendors could have been alleviated in other ways, such as through the automatic stay provision, which would prevent unilateral termination of contracts, or through, you know, injunctive relief, or by operating on a cash basis? In other words, did the bankruptcy court specifically decide whether other means were available to achieve the desired results here.
Your Honor, the other means, for answering the first part of your question, would not have done as good a job. For example,
well, as good a job for you. What about, you know, the rest of the world?
As good a job for the estate and all the other creditors. First of all, Your Honor, the vendors gave up considerable rights. They gave up their lien rights. They gave up their reclamation rights. They were obligated for a period of 2 years to extend unsecured credit, which in the aggregate totaled billions of dollars, and they had to do it on an unsecured basis, on their most favorable terms, which Kmart did not qualify for. The price for that extension of credit is the payment of the pre-petition invoices, which amounted to 0.3% of the total Kmart outstanding indebtedness of over $70 billion. For, so for $268 million, they got billions of dollars of post-petition trade credit on the most favorable terms these vendors could offer. Now, what the testimony in the record is that Mr. Conaway testified that he was not prepared, his company was not prepared to issue payment on a COD basis. They were not set up to do it. They didn't have the cash flow to do it. It would not have worked with their financing. It would have put in jeopardy their debtor-in-possession financing. Yes, Your Honor.
They didn't have the cash flow to sell their merchandise under a system that would induce them to be paid sooner rather than later?
No, Your Honor.
That's incoherent.
What they had to do, Your Honor, was establish normal credit relationships in order to compete. It's very expensive to pay on COD. It's very expensive to issue letters of credit. It's very expensive to do all of those things. Now, one point I'd like to make is that in this context, the Supreme Court articulated that in considering to pay pre-petition expenses, there is no fixed rule in the Fosbick case. In this situation, the bankruptcy court did what the bankruptcy court should do. She considered the motion. She looked for overreaching. Was this at arm's length? She looked at whether there was a necessity and whether there was a benefit to the estate. She considered the views of other creditors. Only capital factors objected.
And did she decide all this on the first day?
In part, yes. In part, at the second hearing. Two of the orders were entered at the second hearing after the creditors' committee looked at them. I may reserve my time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Frank.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Frank. I represent Knight Ritter Incorporated. In addition, a number of the major newspapers in the United States have joined in the briefs we filed. The newspapers made a significant contribution to Kmart's successful reorganization, a reorganization that resulted in distribution of shares of Kmart to the other unsecured creditors that have now doubled in value since the shares were issued. I think regarding the questions that were already addressed concerning other vendors, I think there are good answers with respect to the newspapers. The newspapers and the testimony from Conaway, the CEO of Kmart, showed would not have given the placement Kmart needed for its advertising without the critical vendor payments. The newspapers would not have given Kmart the rates going forward that it needed to survive without the critical vendor payments. And I think both of those things are important because there seems to be a perception in some of the briefing that critical vendor payments are a runaway train, that everybody comes in and grabs as much as they can. But there are a number of organic controls in the bankruptcy system on that. The first is the debtor. The debtor, a Kmart, for example, is fighting for its life the day it files for bankruptcy. It gets a line of debtor-in-possession financing, and it cannot indiscriminately distribute that money. If it does so, it will end up liquidating in Chapter 11 or liquidating in Chapter 7. In addition, the debtor's lenders, who have advanced that money, want the debtor to survive because that's their best chance of collecting all their interest and being paid back, so they don't let the debtor indiscriminately distribute the money. In addition, in a case of this size, and the record is clear, the large creditors all come. The bondholders who have a pure financial interest, they have no interest in seeing the debtor go forward unless they can recover their money, were there that first day and had no objection. In addition, with respect to the two later orders that are on appeal here, the creditors committee, the unsecured creditors committee and the financial creditors committee both approved this because they all saw that this was the only way for this debtor to survive and provide a significant distribution to the entire unsecured creditor body. I think this court recently, within a few days of Judge Grady's opinion, endorsed that concept in the Crawford decision, where Judge Posner acknowledged that there are situations where, despite the policy of equality of distribution, there may have to be some fair discrimination between certain creditors in order for all creditors to receive the most benefit they possibly can. And I'm aware, and I don't have time for rebuttal of a few distinctions, that was a Chapter 13, but there's no functional equivalence between Chapter 13 and Chapter 11 with respect to these issues. They both prevent unfair discrimination, not fair discrimination, and they both imply the absolute priority rule. In other words, creditors of a lower priority are not allowed to receive more than or anything until creditors of a higher priority are paid in full. But there is no rule that payments have to be made in a plan of reorganization, and there is no rule that all creditors at the same priority level have to be classified together or have to be paid the same amount.
You may not be the right person to ask this of, but you're the only person now. So
I'll do my best.
With respect to the argument that that was made, that effective judicial relief is no longer possible. Were those same arguments made to the bankruptcy court as part of the confirmation process?
Some of those arguments were made. This all happened on surprisingly short notice. In other words, there was an amendment to the plan. Everybody rested assured, including the creditors who voted in favor in the plan, that the 549 actions under which theoretically these payments could be recovered were waived.
Well, then, aren't some of those arguments now barred because you didn't appeal the confirmation order?
I don't think so, because I think Judge Grady's ruling was not properly before Judge Sonderby, and I don't think Judge Sonderby's ruling, which simply found that the plan could be amended, is res judicata to the prudential finality issues, which Judge Grady gave short shrift to.
I don't understand
either.
You're effectively waging a collateral attack on the plan of reorganization. One of the earlier steps we took in this case was we entered an order to determine whether briefing should be stayed, inquiring whether there would be an appeal from the plan of reorganization. Of course, the party said no one's appealing from the plan of reorganization. There it is. But now you're asking us, on the ground of the sanctity of the plan of reorganization, to set aside a portion of the plan of reorganization.
I don't think so. What the plan of reorganization does is preserve the right to the extent it exists after this court rules. And we're not asking this court to change the plan. In other words, to the extent this court rules that Judge Grady was right and Judge Sonderby was wrong, there will be an opportunity to bring 549 actions. If this court rules that Judge Sonderby was right, then the 549 actions, the right to bring them will still exist, but bringing them will be useless. I think there's some other important facts that go to the notion of prudential finality here, the fact that it's too late to unscramble the egg. I think it's important to note what the result will be if the court decides that Judge Grady was right. It will be a dilution of the payments to unsecured creditors. In other words, will we exalt this policy, this abstract policy of equality of distribution, and then result that there will be no equal distribution? The money will go to the shareholders of Kmart. It will not go to the unsecured creditors of Kmart. A bounty will go to the Appellee Capital Factors. It will not go to the unsecured creditors of Kmart. There won't be a distribution of equal of this money to all of the unsecured creditors. My time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Frank.
Thank you.
Mr. Tobin.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Tobin. I'm here on behalf of Capital Factors, the appellee, and I would like to, if it please the court, respond to a couple of things that were said before I go into my prepared remarks. First of all, Fleming did not threaten to stop shipping. Fleming did not threaten to stop shipping. The transcript of the hearing, and it's cited at page 11 of our brief, the court asked specifically to Mr. Del Nero, the attorney for Fleming, "You will not ship tomorrow?" Mr. Del Nero, "That's my understanding, but I did not speak with the principal of the company." Now, that's a plain equivocation. And what he was trying to do was trying to persuade Judge Sonderby, without putting somebody on the stand to say that, that in fact there would be this dire consequence. The fact of the matter is that Fleming could not have afforded to lose Kmart as a customer. When they did lose Kmart as a customer, they filed their own bankruptcy, which is pending in Delaware. This is the same situation that happened in the Penn Central case when Consolidated Edison threatened to cut off electricity to the Penn Central Railroad. And the Third Circuit called their bluff and said, not only can't you do that, but I expect that there'll be an injunction action against you if you try. Fleming, it turns out, had a written contract with Kmart, a supply contract. Under this court's ruling in Whitcomb versus Keller, Kmart could have enforced that contract without assuming the contract. So that's plain. If it was really a critical vendor, there were options available to Kmart to require Fleming, provided Fleming was giving adequate protection. And what's the adequate protection that they needed? The day that Kmart filed this case, they filed a motion to approve a $2 billion debtor in possession financing arrangement. Within several hours after this case was filed, Judge Sonderby gave them authority to borrow $1.15 billion. And the reason for that was to make sure that the vendors would ship post-petition. That was the point of it. So certainly they had the resources. Certainly they had other remedies available to them. I asked Mr. Conaway on the witness stand on cross-examination, will you pay these people COD as opposed to losing them? And his response was, no, it's not in our business plan. Well, that's hardly a reason to throw out the bankruptcy code. On the first day of this case, Kmart was authorized essentially to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to 2,330 pre-petition vendors. Now, Judge Sonderby didn't know it was 2,330 vendors. That didn't come out until oral argument before Judge Grady, when the Skadden lawyer was asked the question and she admitted it was that many creditors. This wasn't one or two critical vendors. 2,330 on the first day of the case, 4 hours after the case was filed. On notice to 50 creditors. We did not get notice of that. What happened was is that my client, who was following the Kmart situation, called me and asked me to attend the first day hearing to protect its rights. There's only 50 creditors that got notice. As far as notice to the critical vendors, other than Handelman and Fleming, they were not identified. They still have not been identified. It's amazing to me, even though Judge Sonderby specifically asked for that information on more than one occasion, it still has not been furnished. There was a report and reconciliation filed. It is at
the
record.
Did she order it furnished?
She asked. She requested. It wasn't in a written order. She didn't say, I direct you, Mr. Counsel for Kmart, Mr. Butler, you know, give me this information. I'm not sure, frankly, that Kmart even had the complete list the day the case was filed. What she did is she authorized the payment of this hundreds of millions of dollars based upon the discretion of the debtor to see what kind of deals they could cut, and what they wanted to do was to get customary credit terms from their vendors. They wanted to use this as a tool for negotiating.
It's your view that none of this was done at arm's length, I take it. When you talk about cutting deals, that doesn't sound like you think it's arm's length.
No, I didn't mean to imply that, Your Honor. I think there was negotiation post. There might have been negotiation pre-petition with some of the major vendors, but there was probably negotiation post-petition as far as that. I don't mean to imply that there was any underhanded methods here at all. The second thing I wanted to respond to was the Crawford case, Judge Posner's decision in Chapter 13 with the plan confirmation.
I didn't remind your colleague of it, but it is a decision of the Seventh Circuit, not of a particular judge.
I apologize. It is the court's decision. Judge Posner happened to write it. In that case, not only was it a plan confirmation, it was a classification issue. And what the court did in that case, it denied confirmation because it found that the treatment given to one creditor vis-a-vis the other creditor was unfair discrimination, denied confirmation. In the opinion, the court said there may be an instance where one creditor has to get paid more than other creditors, but it's not 2,330. And it's not $288 million. The examples that were used in that decision were basically paying for the car repair so the consumer could get to work to make his plan work. Judge Rovner, to your question about the arguments before Judge Sonderby on the amendment of the plan, Section 7.14, as a matter of fact, Handelman argued, filed a written objection to confirmation, and then argued the matter about the fairness as to whether or not it would be fair, given all that had gone on in the case, to allow Kmart, after getting the benefit, if they say, from these critical vendors, to go back and then recover the money. Judge Sonderby considered that argument and denied Handelman's objection. So I think that that matter has been ruled on, and I think that the record is clear that it has been ruled on. There's both a written objection and there's a oral argument in the record. Finally, before I get to my other remarks about what I think the law should be and what the law is that Mr. Frank indicated that capital is going to be the beneficiary of these recoveries. That is not correct. It is in a very limited sense. What we did is we basically filed an objection to confirmation on a variety of grounds. And we settled our confirmation objection, and we also basically settled a substantial contribution claim, and we basically used some of the critical vendor payments that they're to be recovered as a source of the settlement with Capital Factors. So Capital Factors is not going to get some kind of windfall here. Capital Factors was owed $20 million at the time this case was filed, and we're going to be recovering a very, very small percentage of what our claim was. The amount that we would get, and that's for a substantial contribution claim, as well as our other claim, is limited to $2 million of the $20 million, plus what we would get under the plan. So it's not like we're going to get this tremendous windfall, and we do think we've made a substantial contribution to the Kmart case. With respect to the law, Your Honor, I think, frankly, that reference to pre-code practice and the doctrine of necessity is frankly inappropriate under the standards set forth by a unanimous Supreme Court decision in Hartford versus Union Planners Bank.
Well, properly or not, courts have long invoked the doctrine of necessity in bankruptcy cases, and if Congress intended to eliminate that option for courts, shouldn't we expect Congress to have made it explicit?
I think they made it pretty clear, and the reason for that, and I think if you take, you read all the cases from the 1800s, the early 1900s, but if you read the Boston and Maine case out of the First Circuit.
I have no desire to read all of the cases from the 1800s and 1900s.
But if you do, you'll see a mix-up of the six-month rule and the doctrine of necessity. But what happened was, when you take a look at the Boston and Maine case, there's three types of pre-receivership claims that were paid as administrative expenses. There's a six-month rule claim. That has been codified in 1171B. There is the Fosdick versus Shawl type of equitable restitution claim. That's been codified in 506C. But you take a look at the doctrine of necessity claims, there's nothing in the code, zero. Your Honors would be legislating
maybe
that.
363B?
Let's talk about 363B.
Let's talk about 363B.
I'm glad Your Honor raised it, because that's becoming the new 105 in the bankruptcy courts, and I think it's a problem.
I hope it's the current 363B.
Okay, well, the 363B issue that has been raised in the briefs, I think we talked about it in this way. 363C allows a debtor to use property of the state in the ordinary course without an order of court. The only time you get an order of court is if it's used out of the ordinary course. Okay?
Order in B.
Well, but this is not out of the ordinary course to pay critical vendors, to pay vendors that are critical to the business. It's out of the ordinary course for the administration of a Chapter 11 estate. As a matter of fact, it's so out of the ordinary course, it's illegal. But it is not. It is not out of the ordinary course of business, Your Honor. Frankly, to pay vendors that are critical, and it's not out of the ordinary course.
The district court actually does what 363B says. It holds a hearing, receives real evidence,
right,
and it finds that for one reason or another, A, it is actually in a vendor's self-interest to carry out a threat to cease dealing, and that B, the consequence of that for the other unsecured creditors would be to make them worse off. You can almost think of this as the inversion of the cram-down situation. The district court, the bankruptcy court, makes those two findings of fact on the basis of record evidence. Why wouldn't 363B allow the payment to that vendor?
Because 363B doesn't allow the payment of pre-petition debts. What it does allow is the debtor to use
That's just the conclusion. It doesn't explain why 363B couldn't be so read.
Well, the plain language doesn't say that. Use 363B to sell property to pay for current value, not to pay old debts. The only reason they used 363B, okay, was to get an order so there would be bulletproof, these transfers would be bulletproof under 549.
Look, as I stated it, there is current value being rendered to the debtor from the source of supply, which would otherwise be unavailable. I'm hypothesizing these findings, and that current value to the debtor yields a net benefit to the other unsecured creditors. And when those conditions are met, why isn't that current value to the debtor enough?
Because it's disproportionate to the payments of the unsecured credit, the expansion of short-term unsecured credit. You're going to pay $288 million to get $288 million of credit.
I'm not asking about this case. I'm asking about the principle. If a bankruptcy court makes those findings, now you may doubt that those findings could have been made in this case, or you may even doubt that those findings could be made in some other case. But if those things are true,
right,
why wouldn't 363B allow that use of the debtor's property?
Because then we might as well throw out 1125 and 1129. All we need to do is have some business justification, and we can use property of the estate under 363B anytime we want for any purpose as long as there's a good business justification. And I think you have to read 363B in the context of the entire code. We're not using 363B.
Now I've got to read all of the decisions from the 18th and 19th century and the entire code. I won't have time to watch Survivor on TV.
Your Honor,
about the rest of us.
I understand. But frankly, if you allow 363B to use that way, then you don't need a plan anymore. And then all you need to do is just have a business justification, and it's a good idea, and you'll get a bankruptcy judge to enter an order to accommodate the debtor. And that's the problem with using 363B. There is nothing in the bankruptcy code that specifically says, there's no explicit provision that says you can't pay a pre-petition debt before plan confirmation, a general unsecured claim. There's nothing that says that. You have to get it from the entire code. That's what 362 is about. It's there to protect the debtor. It's there to protect other creditors as well. It's what 549 was enacted. You know, the predecessor, 70B, only applied in involuntaries under the Act, so now they have 549. They say any transfer post-petition. So you read it, I think, as a whole. And I think you could basically say, you know, if you want to, then we can go to 1108 and say, you know, we can operate the business, therefore we can enter any order we want to operate the business. You know, reorganization is an important principle, and it's better than liquidation in most instances. But as the Sabra Court said, rehabilitation is not an end to be achieved by any means. And as other courts have said, reorganization is not the holy grail to be pursued by any means. We don't throw out other provisions of the bankruptcy code. We don't subvert the policy of equality of distribution in order to achieve a result on a first day. And we don't just throw out the entire scheme. That's what Professor Baird was saying in the portion of his book that we quoted. That judges oftentimes are pressured. I mean, Judge Robin, you're absolutely right. Biggest bankruptcy case ever filed in this jurisdiction. Judge Sonnerby, of course, was pressured on that day. She's not going to screw up this case on day one and take the chance of putting 240,000 people out of jobs. That's why we need appellate courts to make hard and fast rules about this, so we don't have those kinds of pressures where bankruptcy judges are given a stack of motions that are 2 feet high on day one, and they're supposed to approve $2 billion financing deals and 24 other motions, including something like this. So for those reasons, Your Honor, I don't think that 363 or 364, which explicitly says the inducements to extend credit are limited to administrative expenses and liens. You can't use 364 to pay a pre-petition debt. It's been decided three times by three separate courts of appeals. Saybrook said it, the 11th Circuit, Sunrunner, Marine, the 9th Circuit, and Texflon in the 2nd Circuit. That was an Act case, and I know that my opponents are going to get up and say that's a notice case, but there was more than that, because Judge Friendly, who wrote that opinion, made it quite clear well, the Second Circuit wrote the opinion. He authored it for the Second Circuit, I'm sorry. Basically said, in looking, and because he was asked to look at whether or not the new bankruptcy code would inform him as to whether or not...
And the Eighth Circuit hasn't decided that, has it?
On cross-federalization? Not that I'm aware of it. It may have, but I'm not aware of the case.
You've got Payless.
Well, you're talking about the bankruptcy court decision?
Right. No one seems to have, you know...
Payless. What happened in Payless is you had...
I know.
Okay. I won't go into it, but there again, nobody objected to that. There was no DIP financing available in that case. And frankly, there was very little analysis in the cases that Judge Fetterman relied on, frankly, were cases that really weren't applicable. I mean, people cite ionosphere, stick to an ionosphere, and the motion was denied. And the Just for Feet case, it basically relies on the railroad cases. It's plain when Congress enacted 103H of the Bankruptcy Code, and they said the railroad provisions apply only to railroad cases. They made it clear that you're not going to have public interest. The public interest factor in 1165 of the Bankruptcy Code is limited to railroad cases specifically. And public interest, the public interest in keeping the railroads running in the late 1800s, was a crucial factor in the doctrine of necessity. Yet it's clear that the public interest section, which is in 1165, cannot apply to non-railroad cases. The other case that's cited often for the doctrine of necessity in non-railroad cases is Dudley versus Mealy, the Second Circuit decision in the 1940s. It was a Chapter 10 case for a hotel. And that opinion, Second Circuit's opinion, Judge Learned Hand wrote the opinion for the Second Circuit. But there's a lot of distinctions. First of all, that was a plan confirmation issue. It was a classification of claim issue. And in a Chapter 10, of course, the priority section of the Bankruptcy Act, Section 64, didn't apply, just like it didn't apply in a railroad. So there, the reorganization courts were more free, had more flexibility to fashion priorities within Chapter 10 and within railroad cases. Here, we have a priority section of the Bankruptcy Code. It is 507. Those are the priorities. Those are the claims that can be made to be paid prior to other unsecured claims. 503, Congress wanted to say that we're going to have pre-petition claims, the administrative expense claims. They knew how to say it. They said it in 503B3E. They said it in 503B4. They said it in 1171A, and they said it in 1171B. Congress knows how to say we're going to pay a prepetition claim as an administrative expense. They didn't say it here. And frankly, the court would be rewriting the Bankruptcy Code to now say that we can pay prepetition claims outside of a plan on a selective basis, on a willy-nilly basis. Your Honors, I appreciate the time.
No, you're not done. I'm sorry. I did have one question for you, because you argued that it would have been futile for you to have sought a stay in the bankruptcy court. But what I'm wondering, is why you didn't seek a stay in the district court.
Because, quite frankly, my client wasn't going to post a $200 million bond. I mean, we had a lot of money at stake, but not quite that much money. And in UNR, this court said you don't have to get a stay to take an appeal. There is no 363M issue here. We have a good faith purchaser. There's no statutory mootness. There's no 364E application here. The order wasn't entered under 364E, and 364E on its face doesn't apply to a situation like this, because we're not trying to affect the validity of any debt that was created or any lien that was created. And this court's decision in EDC Holding Company said 364E, frankly, is not going to moot an appeal where the purpose of the transaction on its face is contrary to other provisions of the Bankruptcy Code. So there was really, we didn't feel that, number one, there was enough money at stake to post that kind of a bond, and number two, we didn't feel that there was a real sense that the appeal would become moot.
If you prevail here, what's the next step, Lowell?
The next step, Your Honor, is to basically have Kmart proceed to either negotiate settlements with the critical vendors who receive the payments or to file lawsuits. There have been two lawsuits filed. I should inform Your Honors that the case against Meridian, the amicus in this case, was settled. I don't know the terms of the settlement. I'm sure that Kmart got a lot of money. And Kmart benefits. You know, all the unsecured creditors are stockholders of this company now. So if the stockholders of the company get another $200 or $300 million, I think that's a good thing. I think it's going to benefit people that are now stockholders. So all of the creditor body, by use of the avoidance action under 549, are going to benefit. There's just no question about it.
Does Kmart continue to operate?
Kmart?
Does Kmart continue to go?
They are. They are operating.
They are now, I say, if you prevail. Does that matter?
Oh, it's going to help them. I mean, it'll bring money into Kmart. So it'll make them that much stronger, that much of a better competitor, and hopefully the stock is going to go up even more than where it's gone now.
And the creditors have to pay the money back. Is there any assessment or is that to be determined what happens to them?
There will be an adversary proceeding filed. We had asked, because Judge Grady, in his opinion, assumed that the bankruptcy court could order the money returned. We raised that issue before Judge Sonderby, and Judge Sonderby thought that notwithstanding Bankruptcy Rule 6001 that puts the burden on the party who received the money to show why they should keep it, notwithstanding that, she thought that an adversary proceeding under Rule 7001 would be the appropriate vehicle, and Kmart did file two of those cases. Judge Sonderby, and I haven't been involved in those adversary proceedings, but I understand that Judge Sonderby did want to basically take a go-slow approach until this court would rule on the issue, because it may very well moot, because there's a case pending today against Handelman for $49 million. And they wanted to, obviously, as a defendant, slow that down. They wanted to get the ruling out of this court, and Judge Sonderby agreed. But at some point in time, if Judge Grady is affirmed, then it's clear to me that Kmart will pursue the critical vendor claims that are out there. And there's 2,330 potential defendants up there. Now, I'm sure they're not going to sue them all, and I would be surprised if they don't settle most of these things. But there'll be a benefit to the estate. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Godfrey.
Judge Rovner, you asked a very pertinent question on the stay. At the hearing, Mr. Butler had a colloquy with Mr. Tobin and said, if you don't seek a stay and then appeal, it'll be moot, because by the time it all takes place, you won't be able to unscramble the eggs. And he was warned. And he didn't have to worry about a bond, because he could have sought a stay without a bond under Rule 8005. Judge Mannion, you asked the question of what happens to my client. My client is told to pay back $49 million. And I'm going to perhaps try a better answer for or a question Judge Easterbrook asked me. What did my client gave up as a result of this critical vendor order? First of all, it gave up its reclamation rights. Can't get them back. They're gone. Secondly, it didn't file proof of claim, because at that point it didn't have a claim. The July 31st, 2002 date for filing claims is gone. Third, it extended credit on its most favorable terms for 2 years.
Why is proof of claim important? If your client has to pay back the money in a preference avoidance action, it gets a claim as an unsecured creditor to that extent.
We think that's an argument we'll make under 502H, but the plan does not provide for that. And so there's some uncertainty on that part, but in terms of the reclamation,
I think it's just automatic.
I hope you're right if we're in that position. But as to my client, it entered this agreement with Kmart based upon the order. Its employees then were able to get paid, which would not have taken place, by the way, without the critical vendor order, because remember, it's the Handelman employees that make the music stores be capable of being run. And at this point, they thought it was final as to them. And it's no different, I think, Your Honor. I was thinking about your question before as to the person who appeals as to some but not as to others. The person who wasn't already appealed to, any reversal in the Court of Appeals doesn't apply to them. They're not bound by it. That's generally the rules. To sum up, because I'm running out of my part of the time, I'm not going to say anything about the binding of the party. We thought it was final as to us. no different than the cases we've cited. Secondly, on the equities, look at all the things that changed. At this point now, we're going to have to go through all this litigation. We've lost our reclamation rights. We're going to get the diluted distribution at best if we can do a 502H claim. We have been injured along with other innocent creditors. And finally, Mr. Brunson is going to finish on the statutory authorization, but there's one key point. Nothing in the code prohibits what the court did. The Congress knew how to make a prohibition.
No, nothing in the code prohibits awarding the death penalty to certain creditors and vendors, but I don't think he would say that that would be a proper order for a bankruptcy judge.
I agree with that. But had the code...
It can't be the be-all and end-all.
Well, it's not the be-all and end-all, but the assumption is if the code doesn't expressly authorize it, the bankruptcy judge is supposed to sit there while the debtor enters the death spiral. Take the $500 million for Handelman. Who's going to pay the employees? If the employees don't get paid, the testimony from Conaway is, the stores don't run, they lose $500 million. Is it so unfair to pay $49 million to keep a $500 million a year division of the business operational? We don't think so. We spend the remaining time I have, Mr. Brunstad.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Brunstad.
Thank you, Your Honor. In Cohen versus Dela Cruz, the Supreme Court teaches, in other cases as well, that we must read the code not to abrogate prior practice unless Congress expressly intends a change. This doctrine has a long pedigree and ancient history. It applies under the code. It applies under Section 363. It can be applied under Section 364. The creditor, critical vendors in this case, extended credit to the debtor, the terms of which included the payment of the pre-petition invoice. Section 364 authorizes that. Section 364E expressly provides that you can't now pull the rug out from underneath the creditors who relied. My client relied in good faith. It gave up its reclamation rights. It gave up its lien rights. It extended credit post-petition in good faith to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. It took the risk of non-payment. It was an unsecured creditor. It had a priority behind that of the DIP lender, the secured lenders, and the 507B priority claimants. It took that risk. At this point in time, it is too late to say, oh, sorry, you took that risk. Now you have to bear, in addition to the risks you took, the risk of having the rug pulled out from underneath you, where the other side did not seek a stay. Section 364E is expressed on this point. You don't seek a stay, and then you don't get to overturn it on appeal. And I think that the analysis that this court undertook...
Thank you, Mr. Brunstad.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.